Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We start today with a question. Are we ready to do, will we do, what we know we need to do? Here is Massachusetts General Hospital physician Joseph Bettencourt on our air, April 2020, as we were just learning about COVID-19, raising the specter of who the virus might harm the most.
We know that natural disasters and disasters of this nature always disproportionately impact minority and vulnerable communities. And I think this one is no exception.
We knew before the pandemic even started. Fast forward 2 years, disproportionate rates of infection, rates of vaccination, economic impact from the pandemic, and then recent data analysis by the Boston University School of Public Health and the Boston Globe found disproportionate fatality rates for Hispanic and Black residents in Massachusetts. We knew, and it still happened. Can we keep it from happening again? We have invited Dr. Joseph Bettencourt back 2 years later to talk with us about that. He is Senior Vice President for Equity and Community Health at Massachusetts General Hospital. Dr. Bettencourt, thanks for joining us. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me.
Appreciate it. Has it been worse than you even thought in those early days, Doctor?
Yeah, you know, I think it's been worse because it just kept coming back. And the damage we saw was just, you know, happening over and over again. Fundamentally, when I was on 2 years ago, we did have hope that that surge would kind of go away eventually and that we'd be able to get back to normal. We certainly didn't anticipate Delta. We didn't anticipate Omicron. And we did everything we could along the way to address some of the disparities that I mentioned. But at the end of the day, we were, you know, collectively as a nation, as a community, really behind the eight ball. We were behind, and it's hard to play catch up. So it's been hard. It's been difficult. It's taken a toll. And I think our topic today really demonstrates that, unfortunately, what we talked about and predicted at that time came true just as we expected.
You just said we did everything we could. I'm a little surprised to hear you say that we did everything we could. And I'd love to hear you just give us a quick rundown. What are the things we did?
Yeah, and when I say we did everything we could, I think we did everything within our power to try to address some of these disparities. But, you know, these waters that we were swimming upstream against are very powerful. They're longstanding. The kind of issues that led to the spread of COVID in the first place couldn't be quickly fixed. And so whereas we did everything in our power, and I'll articulate some of those things, certainly we were constantly swimming upstream. So what did we do? You know, 2020, if we go back, we started quickly thinking about how do we get testing in areas that are being hit hard and do it in a way that's equitable, centering equity in that work, and then quickly pivoting to say, okay, when people are hospitalized, how do we meet their language and cultural needs to make sure that they're informed, that they're getting taken care of well? How do we address food insecurity that's happening or other, you know, some of these root causes that led to these disparities in the first place that all became worse during the pandemic? And certainly when the vaccine came out, how did we try to do our best to make sure that we were messaging to the community in a culturally and linguistically appropriate way the importance of getting vaccinated and, most importantly, positioning and putting vaccines in vulnerable communities? So, you know, we did a lot. I'm very proud. But ultimately, when you're swimming upstream and at that pace and facing some of these big challenges, your best is not good enough. This requires, you know, years of effort. And this is the challenge in front of us now, is how do we prevent this from happening? And how do we apply these lessons to things like diabetes and asthma? This is really a lot about public health, addressing these social issues and issues of how we make healthcare more accessible to everyone.
So let's stay in the here and now for a second, and we'll also look ahead. I know you work with Dini Paulino, the chief operating officer of La Collaborativa in Chelsea, who says they have, quote, close to 50 members who have lost their breadwinners, end quote. What are the community impacts of that kind of loss, the public health impacts of that kind of loss today and going forward?
You know, any loss of life is tragic. 23,000 people, you know, passed from COVID in our state. 1,700 in their prime years, right? The Globe made that very clear. And back in March and April of 2020, these young individuals were the ones that we were seeing being admitted and getting sicker. And it was really scary And I think that was one of the scariest things about the pandemic early on, is that the research we were beginning to get said, you know, if you have a chronic disease, if you're older, you're going to do less well. And we knew that communities of color coming into the pandemic, suffering these disparities from a whole variety of reasons due to, you know, socioeconomic status, a social condition, the way COVID spread, you know, being essential workers, being hit hard, being hit early. You know, we all knew that, but we started to see people who were younger getting sicker, and it really tagged very nicely to being an essential worker and living in a vulnerable community in a place where there was multi-generational housing in a place that was densely populated. So we began to see that loss early. And the impact of that loss is devastating over generations, I would say. Certainly, if as we have lost many, many people who are incredibly important to us who are older, fundamentally, those individuals may not be contributing to the economic, sustenance of a family and be a provider, right? And so while incredibly tragic, it's a difference, no matter who you are, or where you're from, by race or ethnicity, if a caregiver is struck down, passes, and now you have a two-parent home that's a one-parent home, or God forbid, one-parent home that's a no-parent home. The impact on kids, on their emotional health, on their ability to already deal with challenging situations in their community, be able to, you know, fend off anxiety and depression due to the pandemic in and of itself, this will have implications in communities of color for likely a generation or two to come.
And just to underscore that, some of the data from the Globe Report on their work with BU, among Hispanic people aged 20 to 49, the death rate was nearly three times higher than for non-Hispanic white people. Among non-Hispanic black people, the rate was 2.5 times higher, just to underscore what you're saying. All right, so let's look to today and tomorrow. If you had to pick, like a dashboard, right, two or three levers that you would just want to see us relentlessly go after to improve our healthcare ecosystem for people of color and marginalized communities, what are the two or three things you would organize everybody around to work on, let's say, in the next, 12 to 24 months?
I think we are in a unique position in time and in this city to bring together resources from the public and private industry who now fundamentally understand the impact of things that we've been talking about, certainly for the 20 years of my career that I've been involved in this work. We have had long, hard problems that we have not attempted to solve in a collaborative way. And I think now is the time to really bring all those resources to bear, all those partners to bear, and finally tackle some of the big challenges and the big disparities we see. So I could list them out, and they're all the ones that you might expect, and we could pick a couple of them. Certainly maternal health and infant mortality are a very big one, and it's been a very big challenge for this city for years in the shadow of some of our best hospitals, seeing infant mortality disparities between black and white women that parallel what we see in third world countries. So that's one, certainly. Chronic disease, so what we call cardiometabolic disease, that spectrum of diabetes and high blood pressure, these really have a series of root causes that if we address them, we could stamp out a couple of them, right? So healthy foods, building up our public health infrastructure, more public space. So I would try to go for some of these that are sticky, some of these that are hard, some of these that we can ultimately address multiple challenges through a series of basic interventions. But we need to do that as a united city and as a collaborative. And I would end that this will improve the health of all Bostonians and greater Bostonians, not just those who are vulnerable. We will learn, we will deploy, we will scale activities that undoubtedly will not only address disparities, but improve quality and health outcomes for all in our city and around our city.
You just talked about the collaboration you'd like to see, and you said we now fundamentally understand. And that really struck me. You heard me say at the top of the show, we knew before COVID, we knew about disproportionate impacts. Is there something, maybe not everybody did know, maybe not everybody was paying attention. Have we collectively, in our collective conscience, learned a lesson we hadn't taken in before in these last 2 years between the disproportionate impacts of COVID, our dramatically increased awareness and public discourse around racism after, for example, the murder of George Floyd? Are we in a moment, even though there was data there before, where people know and understand and have will in a way that maybe we didn't?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this was the single biggest global case study, certainly national and absolutely local case study of racial ethnic disparities in health and healthcare and health outcomes. I think this touched everyone, and the data does not lie. This data is clear. It proves everything we knew. It was everything we expected. But, you know, I think over the years we've seen a lot of, well, but maybe not so bad, you know, a lot of kind of hedging, quite frankly, on the real impact of these disparities. And I think these last 2 years between the pandemic, between our national reckoning on racism, have really, you know, put all of this front and center in ways that are unprecedented, certainly in my career. And it's at these inflection points in history that we need to kind of, you know, grab as much ground as we can to make progress. And again, have the courage to take all the lessons we've learned and deploy them, not 5 years from now, but now. And I'm hopeful. I think we do have unity around this. And despite some, you know, political pushback that you might expect, I think ultimately we need to communicate to all of our community members, no matter, you know, what their race or this is, that this work is the work of good health in the state of Massachusetts and in the greater Boston area.
So, Dr. Betancourt, in this vision for collaboration, especially to take on, you know, maternal health and infant mortality or chronic diseases, you talked about the private sector, the healthcare sector, government, nonprofits. We know who the leaders of those organizations are. We're not that big a city. We know who needs to come to the table. Are you seeing tables set, and are you seeing the necessary players sit at them now?
Without question. You know, I think it's exciting, right? Because we did that with healthcare reform. As you said, you know, everybody, this is a city that is well connected. And so if you look at our leaders, people like Lee Pelton now at the Boston Foundation, if you look at our leaders, you know, Mayor Wu and Dr. Ojukwutu, who heads up the Boston Public Health Commission. If you look at our health system leaders, our health center leaders, you know, a gentleman who I had the pleasure of being on this show with several times, Michael Curry. I mean, we have a critical nexus of individuals who are starting to come together to think, to strategize, and it will take resources, undoubtedly. But I'm excited about what this has catalyzed. And, you know, shame on us, quite frankly, if we can't make progress, given where we are and who we have and how we need to do this work.
So you sound hopeful.
I am. I'm very hopeful. And but, you know, hope carries us a long way. It's the evidence that makes a difference. And so we need to get about this work quickly. I'm hoping that now, again, with hope that this surge is our last and we could really dig in on this in a very deliberate way and get, you know, all those people at the table, as you've said. And these are people who are willing to work together in ways, I think, that I've never seen before. And it's not because they didn't want to before, it's just they didn't have the right catalyst to set that table the way we need it and the way our community members need it.
All right. Dr. Joseph Betancourt is Senior Vice President for Equity and Community Health at Massachusetts General Hospital. Thanks for joining us again today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
One of the most popular shows on television is HBO Plus's Succession, about some truly brutal internal squabbles in a family media empire. Family business squabbles are not just in the realm of fiction, though. Here in Greater Boston, the Berkowitz brothers behind Legal Seafood had a public falling out in the 1990s. The Demoulas family behind Market Basket has been to the state Supreme Court twice to untangle family feuds, and now the Delios. The five Delio siblings are equal co-owners of Cane's Donuts, but President and CEO Paul Delios is suing his four siblings, saying that he has been the one responsible for the executive decisions at Cane's, decisions he claims increased annual sales from $500,000 to more than $8 million during his 15 years of leadership, and he says that now his siblings are trying to push him out. Here with us to break that story down, Grant Welker, a reporter for the Boston Business Journal. Grant, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the basic allegations here, Grant, what's the back and forth?
You did cover it a bit pretty well. Yeah, so Paul has been with Cane's since 1988, working for his parents then, and he's been the president since 2007. As you said, the company has expanded and done quite well during his time. It's opened in Boston and opened a second store in Saugus. The complications here is that Paul and his four siblings each share a 20% stake in the business. They all also serve on the company's board. And they apparently have long had a strained relationship with one another, to the point where Paul says that last summer he was dismayed by their infighting and wanted to get out of the business. But the siblings then, he says, reversed course and decided not to sell.
So Paul was going to sell his share. He wanted to wash his hands of it and just sell his shares to the siblings. And then that didn't happen.
That's right. The company that he had run since 2007, he wanted out. He wanted to sell and get out of it because of the infighting that he cited. And the sort of irony there is that the infighting has since gotten so much worse. It's now spilled out in a very public way and in a very ugly way because of this lawsuit. After his siblings said that they wouldn't buy his shares, he decided that instead, if he couldn't get out entirely, he would try to he would expand his ownership from 20% to 40% by buying out his brother, Stephen, who, and this is a serious allegation here, is that he says that Stephen was fired last summer because of allegations of sexually inappropriate behavior by 8 employees.
And has Stephen commented on those, or do we have any?
He has not. No, and it's important to stress that both Stephen and the other siblings have not returned our messages for comment, and they have not yet filed anything in court in response. So we don't have their side yet.
Okay, so now we've got this suit. It's a sibling versus sibling. Again, something that seems right out of the pages of fiction, but is really happening here. How much money is at stake, and how does this proceed?
It's really not clear. We're not talking, you mentioned, like with Legal Seafoods, or especially with the DeMoulis family with Market Basket, it's not nearly at that scale in terms of the amount of money, like how much each side or any side would have to pony up to buy out their siblings. Here we're talking about $1 million or so for an individual sibling's shares. But what could possibly be at stake potentially is the family's ownership or management of the company. It's hard to look at sort of how they turned back the clock and work with one another, either in an ownership sense or with management after a lawsuit that's so public and so ugly like this, where Paul is saying some pretty cruel things about a few of his siblings. He called himself the only financially successful one of the group. How does a family like this deal with each other, not just as family members, as siblings, but as business partners? That's the complication that a lot of family business experts cite, is how you're able to deal with one another, not just as siblings or as parents and children or whatever the case may be, but also as business partners. And it can be very complex and very difficult to balance both roles that are in place there.
Well, that is where we're going to turn next. So we appreciate the setup here. Grant Welker, a reporter for the Boston Business Journal, thanks for talking with us.
Of course. Thank you.
So let's talk to an expert. Ted Clark, director of Northeastern University Center for Family Business, has been studying family-owned businesses for more than 20 years. Ted, thanks for joining us here in Studio 3.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
So first, reactions to what you just heard.
Well, I think Grant summed it up pretty well. There's a power struggle between 5 owners, and it has become rather messy and in the public through a lawsuit. It's, you know, as Grant had mentioned, it's a little one-sided in its presentation. And we haven't seen their response, but I can't imagine they're going to nod their head and agree. I would assume that it will be ugly from the other side as well. So
I grew up in a household with a family business. One of my siblings eventually bought the business from my parents. I saw a pretty healthy environment, but I wonder, is this typical what we're seeing? I mean, we've got some big family business examples here in Boston. Are these kinds of family business disputes not unusual?
So what I would say is that when you see these things play out in the public, it seems like it's like any family. Everybody has their issues. I think you're pretty hard pressed to find any family, not just in a family business, that, you know, everything's hunky dory and smooth. So I think these are pretty common. It's just human nature, and it plays out. And some people play the game a little more smoothly and with a little more care than what we see now.
So what is fascinating to you about this?
It's life. It's interactions. It's people interacting with each other. It's business. It's one way to look at it. I always think of people fight over one of three things: it's power, sex, and money. And so it's right there. It's power and primarily power and money and control. And it goes back. I look at it. One of the best books I believe for family businesses to understand is to read Machiavelli, The Prince. It plays out just like it did back then. It's just human nature since the beginning of time, and it's fascinating to watch. And you mentioned the show Succession. It's not far-fetched to think that that's really the way things happen.
So there are people's livelihoods tied up in this, people's jobs. There's small business presence that can anchor communities and sell products that people value. There's a lot at stake when a family can't figure out how to make this work.
Yeah. There's an awful lot. There's employees, vendors, customers, the family itself. And so the question I would always ask is, what, and I would ask it to this family, what's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish with this squabble? Nothing good is going to come from this. So you really have to ask, what's the motivation and what are you trying to get out of it? And so if you were to study a theory on family business, one of the ones I would always suggest is family systems theory, the Bowen theory, and you'd start to look at how people become fused and they act emotionally. And you can see that's what's going on here. There's not the concept is referred to as self-differentiation, where you become more rationally thinking and self-directed with what you're doing. These people seem, at least from the outside perspective, to be emotionally fused together, where they're not able to step back and really look at the bigger picture to see what they're trying to accomplish. And that's what they really need to start to think about doing. It might be a little too late for them because it's now become public. It makes it more difficult to step back and be rational.
Have you seen a case, especially a local case, where families got into the thick of it, right, where there was this Machiavellian feud, but they were able to work it out and there was a positive moving forward in one way or another?
So one of the things that makes this interesting is when they work well, you really don't know the machinations behind the scenes. It's what they project to the outside world.
When they work well, meaning the business, the family? What do you mean when you say they?
Both. It's enmeshed. It's hard to separate the family from the business. So when the family and the business work well, it's presented as a phenomenal business. And when a family business works well, you can't beat them. They're altruistic. They're focused. They're great with their customers. They'll invest for the long term.
So give us a couple of examples of local or regional family businesses that seem to be working well and meeting those criteria.
I would look at Fidelity. Fidelity's a phenomenal company, and they seem to be really doing things well. I'd also look at the Kraft Group with the Patriots. Every now and then we'll hear a little speed bump that they hit, but they always seem to be able to bring it, keep it private, keep it behind closed doors like a good family and come to a resolution with what they're doing. So you don't see the problems, and that's what they want. They don't want the problems to be public. And those work well.
So is it the case then, am I hearing from you, basically, so I'm pretending I'm going to read the business section for the next 20 years, right? I'm going to see more examples of this. And when I see one that hits the papers because it's hit the courts, am I supposed to then say to myself, oh, this is one that's not likely to be able to be resolved well because it hit the courts? If they were able to keep it under control, it wouldn't have gotten this far.
Yeah, once it hits the papers, it's really hard to pull it back because things get said that you don't want said, and it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle, if you will. And once I kind of look at it as like a little playground. Once you're not playing well in the playground, and once they're in the sandbox and they're not doing well, they turn it into a kitty litter box, and it's kind of hard to go back into that box again.
So what about the Demoulases and Market Basket? Do you think that sort of blew up, or did they just survive the pains? Or so remind people what happened there, how they ended up, and what's your take on that?
So one of the things that I look at when I think of a family business, they talk about succession. going from one generation to the next.
There's that word again.
Succession?
Yeah.
So I don't look at it quite like that. I look at succession between generations and within generations. And it's a control, it's a fight over control and power. And so if you look at Market Basket, that was a fight within the generation. If you look at the...
Between the brothers.
Between the cousins.
Excuse me, cousins.
If you look at this fight, it's within the generations, between them again. So, and this one is a coercive where they're fighting over it. So you fight over power and money. You fight over the management, leadership, and ownership. And now they're fighting over ownership. The way it works out well is one of them will buy the other out. The business will go back to steady, hopefully, will go back to a steady state and thrive. And that part of the family will go off and do other things. And that's what you saw at Market Basket. That's what you saw at one of the oldest businesses in the country, if not the oldest non-farm family business in the United States, is in Massachusetts, Zildjian Symbols. They had a fight within the family, and one of the brothers went off to start their largest competitor, Sabian Symbol. So now you have the oldest family business, the largest symbol manufacturer in the world, a thriving family business, and their largest competitor is a family member.
And would you say that's been healthy for their industry? I mean, most of us don't probably spend a lot of time thinking about the industry of symbols, but, symbols being with percussion instruments.
Yeah.
But has it been healthy for the industry to see that competition?
I would dare say, I haven't quite thought of it like that. But I would think it is, because now you have two thriving cymbal manufacturers in the marketplace, and they're both doing very, very well.
So what are you going to watch for in this Cane's Donuts case as it unfolds?
Well, hopefully it'll be somewhat like the Demoulas family. You'll see something happen, something change, and then you won't hear from them anymore, because family businesses bring new meaning to the phrase private business. You know, when they're private businesses like that, they don't want to advertise what they're doing. So what I would hope for this family is that they would come to some agreement on what they're trying to accomplish individually. They'd make an agreement. They'd go down that path. They'd legally structure a deal so that they could probably separate ownership within the family to a consolidated group of one or two, so you won't have that imbalance.
You won't have five.
Exactly. And that's what I refer to in the middle. That's the most unstable type of a family business. Because this is exactly what happened with Demoulas. It was the swing of one person, I think, because it's hard to get the exact data because it is private, but the swing of one vote changed who's in power. And that could happen here. They could have a quick change of power and then restructure the ownership of the business. It goes on to even bigger and better things, hopefully, I would assume, under Paul's leadership, because he seems to be the one that has the skill to grow it. If he would acquire it, he could grow it, triple it, double it, franchise it, do all kinds of great things with it.
All right, last question before I let you go. You've given us a lot of examples of what is typical and how these things tend to work. Have you seen a local business example that was truly atypical, something you're like, wow, I just have not seen that before? Or is there really nothing new under the sun?
Well, I've got a couple of ones that I think are just stellar examples of great business behavior. I think KM Foods is one, for an example. They have KM hot dogs. They have alfresco chicken sausage. I love their products. That's one of my favorites. If you look at another one locally that's grown phenomenally in the last few years under the leadership of two brothers, is Scrub-A-Dub, the car wash company. That's another great one. Out in a little more western Mass, Koopman Lumber. They've grown phenomenally under the leadership of the next generation. So when you see them work well, you can't beat them. They really are powerful businesses.
All right. And lessons that you would take away for somebody who's starting a family business now? One or two pieces of advice?
Ownership matters. That is the key driving factor to control within the family business. They're kind of like a family business is kind of like a nuclear reactor or an atom bomb. They're both very...
I did not see that coming.
Both very, very powerful. One is destructive, but it's all about having control. And if there's control, you can create tremendous energy.
All right. Ted Clark is director of the Northeastern University Center for Family Business, helping us look at this most recent Cane's Donuts case. Ted, thank you so much for being here in Studio 3 today.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
24 hours into daylight savings time. Are you yawning yet? There are some serious haters out there over it. Not haters of the extra sunshine, but of the fact that we don't have it all year round. In just a bit, we'll welcome Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey, co-sponsor of a bill in Congress to save daylight permanently. But first, a local effort. And we want to hear from you. Do you want to spring forward for good? Or do you like the extra morning sunlight during the dark days of winter? Call us with your preferences. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So Tom Emsweiler is a Quincy-based health advocate who has actually submitted legislation on the subject, and we spoke with him earlier today. When we talked, I started by noting that the twice-annual time change must really, really annoy him.
Yeah, it does. You know, growing up in Virginia, I would always really enjoy the time change because when we changed the clocks in the spring, I would be able to play outside after dinner. But I didn't think about it too much otherwise. When I moved in 2011, when I moved from Virginia to Massachusetts, I knew I was moving north, but I had no idea how far I was moving east. So you can imagine my horror, my first December here, when the sun set at 4:11 p.m. And I thought to myself, there has to be a better way.
So this better way, the solution you've come up with, is that there's actually a time zone that is the equivalent of being on daylight savings time all year, right?
Yes, that's true. For here in New England, you know, we're really in the eastern end of the eastern time zone. And the nature of daylight saving time is it's temporary. You know, there's recent federal legislation that talks about making it permanent, but you know that in essence, daylight saving time is always a temporary thing. And so I thought to myself, what if we should actually be one time zone east, and then we could opt out of the switch, which, you know, is what states like Arizona do. Arizona doesn't switch back and forth, pick one time and stick with it. So we could do that here in New England. We could move to Atlantic time, and then just every November, instead of falling back, we would do nothing.
Okay, so if it were that easy, given how much we all hate the soul-crushing nature of the 4 o'clock darkness in the winter, I feel like we would have already done it. So why haven't we?
You know, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's such a popular idea that you're seeing a lot of momentum, which is why, you know, I wrote an op-ed in the Globe in 2014 that proposed this idea, which, you know, was fairly popular. As far as why it hasn't happened yet, you know, it's, with all due respect to Schoolhouse Rocket, it's hard to change the law, you know. Inertia can be a big thing sometimes.
What made you decide to file legislation as a private citizen, and what's happened with it since you did?
Sure, yeah. Well, there have actually been a couple of bills. So after the op-ed was popular, about a year after that, I reached out to my state senator and said, what if you all did a bill to propose a study? And they said, well, we're not going to do a bill, and we don't do studies, but you could do a citizen by request bill to have a commission. That might work. And I said, okay, I've never heard of that, but that works great. And so we submitted that in summer of 2015, I believe. And then about a year later, my little tiny bill got inserted into the economic development bill. And so before I knew it, my little bill that could became law. And so the following year in January 2017, we had a commission with 11 members to study the issue. So we had hearings and people testify and that sort of thing. And at the end of that, in November of 2017, we released a report that said, you know, with careful consideration, Massachusetts and neighboring states could move to Atlantic Standard Time. It would be good.
It would be good to do that. So again, yeah. Has anybody filed a bill since then just to get it done?
Yeah, absolutely. So then after that, we filed a bill to make the change. So that was first filed in 2019. Basically saying if Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New Hampshire, and Maine all pass similar resolutions, we would go together, our four states, to the U.S. Department of Transportation to petition that department to allow us to move to Atlantic Standard Time. The U.S. Department of Transportation is who controls time zones, because the reason we have time zones is because in the late 19th century, we had the train system. And so a train leaving Boston going to Springfield, you know, the times were different because it was based on the sun. And so we established time zones to basically standardize that. So that bill failed. But so it was refiled last year. And so currently it is with a committee in the legislature.
So my understanding is travel and transportation could still be an issue here. You would have potentially Massachusetts, so a place like Logan, out of sync for at least 4 months of the year if we were in the Atlantic time zone. because other states would be swinging back and forth and we wouldn't. And I also do think about people, I don't like leaving work into the dark in the winter, but there are many who now go to work in the dark during daylight savings time. What about them?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, it's an interesting question that if there's only so much light, so if we shift the light to the evening, we're losing in the morning. And so I think we just need to think about what do people prefer most of the time. So right now in the summer, the sun rises about 5 a.m. in Boston. And so if we had standard time, the sun would rise at 4 a.m. in Boston, which means it would get light around 3:30 a.m. Now, I know there's a lot of joggers out there, but light at 3:30 a.m. I think is be a little wasteful for most of us.
And in your 2014 op-ed, Tom, you cite public health, you cite energy savings, you cite depression. There are some other research that you cite that suggests there would be real benefits to this, yes?
That's right. So we know in the fall, everyone gets an extra hour of sleep, and isn't that great? But in the spring, we experience, you know, Sleepy Monday, which is after we give millions of people jet lag. And we know from research that there are more heart attacks, more car accidents, and more workplace accidents because everyone is jet lagged. We also learned through the commission that we have cyberloafing, which is people who maybe sit at a computer all day. They're less likely to have a workplace accident, perhaps, but they're more likely to visit websites like ESPN.com or something like that, as opposed to...
After a time change?
Yeah, because they can't focus. And so if it's hard to focus, you're more likely to dawdle.
All right. So, Tom, you know, pun completely intended here. Do you think this time around there's legislation at the State House? Has the time come for this time change?
I hope so. You know, we're pushing it. It seems to be very popular with the average person on the street. And certainly there's federal legislation as well to adopt year-round daylight saving time. So I think there's a lot of interest in this issue. So it could be.
All right. Tom Emsweiler is a health advocate and former congressional health policy aide who lives in Quincy, Massachusetts. Tom, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Turning now to the federal push for permanent daylight saving time, Senator Ed Markey is a co-sponsor on a bipartisan bill called the Sunshine Protection Act. Senator Markey, welcome back.
No, glad to be with her, and it's great to be back. Thank you.
Sunshine protection does not sound particularly controversial. Why wouldn't we always all want to protect the sun, Senator?
Well, you know, there are forces of darkness out there. There are people who like to live in the shadows. But I think for most people, they just think after a long, dreary winter, people are ready to go from polar to solar. And they wonder why they can't have more of it. Because it does make people feel better. It makes the corners of their mouths turn upwards in a smile, knowing that tonight they're going to be able to walk around in the sunshine until 7, 7.15, 7.20, and just feel a lot better about the world that they're in.
So as I understand it, only two states currently don't switch back and forth, Arizona and Hawaii. 48 do switch back and forth in some way. How complicated would it be to do this? Because I think you're actually proposing that the whole country is permanently on daylight saving.
Well, in 1986, I was the chairman of Over Energy, and time as an issue is reposed in the Energy Subcommittee. And so and on that date, 8 months of the year was standard time, and 4 months was daylight savings time. So I'm sorry.
The other way around.
6 months. It was 6 months and 6 months.
Okay.
6 months daylight, 6 months standard. So in 86, I was able to move it from the end of April up to the beginning of April. Then in 2005, again, partnering with Fred Upton, a Republican from Michigan, I was able to move it from the beginning of April to the second week of March and add a week at the end of October into the beginning of November for Halloween. So now it's 8 months daylight savings time, 4 months standard.
I'm proud of
the 2 months I've been able to get back. But I think people, when they have it the first couple of nights, they say, why can't it be like this all the time? And again, we'd have to have a negotiation and maybe allow a state to opt out if they want, the way Arizona does. But for the most part, I think that when you create that kind of uniformity, that people adjust to it and are happy that they have the hour where they can use it in the evening.
So we've got a caller, Elaine in Cambridge, not a big fan of this idea. Elaine, go ahead briefly.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. And it's very clear from sleep research that people sleep better when on standard time than on daylight savings time. And I found it so much easier to make the adjustment the end of April. It was just more in fitting with the season. It's the move back to March I have found really difficult and really hard on my sleep.
Thanks.
So I would love to go back to that. I know it's not likely. So, you know, I would hate to lose those 4 months of the year to get better sleep in the winter.
Thanks for that call, Elaine. So, Senator Markey, you were pleased to get it from 6 months down to 4 months of standard time. Elaine's saying, hey, it affects sleep. What do you know, Senator, about the health benefits either way of daylight saving time versus standard time and the balance and the switching?
Well, what I know is that by making our days brighter year-round, we can permanently speed up the clock on seasonal affect disorder triggered by the dark days of winter. So to the extent to which, you know, beginning last night and tonight, people can start walking around. You know, they can go shopping in the daylight. They can play tennis. Little League can start. They can just walk around the neighborhood. All of those things are now much more likely, and people feel better when they have that sunshine in their life. You know, T.S. Eliot said that April is the cruelest month, you know, because that's when you really see seasonal affect disorder after a long, long winter. The more we move up the daylight to more days that people can enjoy it, is the quicker that we reduce seasonal affect disorder. So I believe that it's actually the daylight. And we actually know that, for example, in America, that Washington State, Seattle, they have the highest rates of depression, and San Diego has the lowest rates. And a lot of it is just sun-related. It's light-related. And we just get a chance here by adjusting the time to help us up in Massachusetts, but all across the country.
So I want to talk about the politics of this for a second, Senator. There's more than one co-sponsor. It is not lost on me that Florida Senator Marco Rubio is a co-sponsor on this with you. In all seriousness, bipartisanship right now is in short supply. Is this a vehicle to exercise the muscles of bipartisanship, and could it lay the groundwork? You know, you mentioned policy on this comes out of the Energy Committee. Does it lay the groundwork for other policies that might have or could have bipartisan support, in all seriousness here?
Well, we do have a dearth of bipartisanship in the Senate at this particular moment in time. Although we are cooperating a lot, I will be honest, in terms of the humanitarian aid and other aid that we're sending to Ukraine. We're doing that unanimously on a bipartisan basis, $13 billion just last Friday. So we can see that for some people, it's just bringing tears to their eyes that they're seeing Democrats and Republicans coming together and working on that. Here, by the way, in 1 hour at 5 o'clock today, Marco Rubio, Republican, conservative from Florida, and Ed Markey, liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, are going to stand on the Senate floor and make a unanimous consent request that we pass this Sunshine Protection Act. And right now we have 9 Republican co-sponsors, 8 Democratic co-sponsors. We're trying to go one on each side all the way so that we can make this ultimately bipartisan. And I do agree that it does help to bring together Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, in a way that we need more of, because the country really is thirsting for that at this time.
So you mentioned Ukraine. Let's stay there now. And you mentioned, you know, bipartisan support for the $13 billion in relief. You called very strongly on the Biden administration last year to ban Russian oil. President Biden enacted an executive order on that. Are you seeing the results that you wanted over the last several days?
Well, yes, you know, because for years, Americans have lined Putin's pockets by buying, last year, for example, $20 billion of American consumer money went to Putin and his oligarchs.
because we were importing that oil and putting it into our gasoline tanks. And I don't think America should be financing Putin's war machine. So there is bipartisan support for doing this. It's 600,000 barrels a day. But to put it in another context, we have 600 million barrels of oil in our strategic petroleum reserves. So we could deploy the amount of oil that we import from Russia on a daily basis out of our strategic petroleum reserve for 1,000 days in a row. But we have to do more than that. We're going to need a windfall profits tax on the oil companies. They're tipping consumers upside down and reporting historic profits. So there's a lot of other things we have to do, but I think the right thing is to make sure that we're not financing Vladimir Putin and his war machine.
I'm aware of the push for the windfall profits tax. I want to stay on Russian oil for a minute longer here, Senator, with our limited time. You want to see that permanent. Why? And, you know, for 1,000 days is one thing. Permanent is something else. Could it run the risk of, counter to what I understand in your Green New Deal agenda, leading to more drilling and more local production of oil or fossil fuels?
Well, right now, the oil and gas industry has 9,000 leases on land and another 3,000 leases offshore on federal public land that they have not drilled on yet, in an area the size of Indiana. So if the oil and gas industry wants to drill, why have they not been doing it on that land? But we don't have to give them any new land, that's for sure. No additional pristine federal public lands from the United States. What this does is give us an opportunity. And the opportunity is to say, well, what does 600,000 barrels a day equal? And it's 16 million all-electric vehicles. So if we deployed 16 million all-electric vehicles, we don't need any more oil from Russia. If we deployed another 16 million, we don't need any more oil from Saudi Arabia, and so on and so on. And so for us, it's a chance to unleash a technological revolution, to move to wind and solar and battery storage technologies and all electric vehicles and other energy innovation technologies, and just say we're going to destroy the Russian business model, that we don't need their oil any more than we need their caviar. And by the way, that we don't need any Saudi oil any more than we need their sands. But it's about time, and that's what a younger generation wants. They want us to stand up. They want us to finally, you know, say we are a technological giant. We can unleash all the technologies that don't require the oil and natural gas that we've been consuming. So I think this is an inflection point, and we as a nation have to take this moment in partnership, by the way, with the Europeans. So I'll give you a number. The Germans, even before this war started, were going 65% all electric vehicles by 2030, 9 years from now. So that gives us our own moonshots, 9 years. To get there, to match them, and to basically destroy the business model of those who have been selling us, getting us addicted to the oil and gas from their countries.
All right, U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, Ed Markey, thanks for joining us here on Radio Boston. And we'll say goodbye to the senator there. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks so much for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.